and I thought how much we could learn if we could, if the scapegoat could speak. And that's basically what I tried to do in my book. Not just understand whistleblowers, but understand the organization from the perspective of the whistleblower, which I think is really quite a profound perspective. The trouble is it results in what's been called knowledge is disaster. Now, I'm going to be using a couple of phrases that have been coined by others, and it's all fully documented in my book, but I want to, I don't think I'll sort of give sources in my talk. I will use air quotes when I'm quoting people. So, like I say, that what does the scapegoat know? What can he or she tell us? Now, it's complicated because whistleblowers speak in many registers, such as shock, trauma, loss, depression. And I have to tell you, quite honestly, that Jen is very unusual in winning her case, winning it so decisively, having the President of the United States representing her before he was president. But for the most part, I spoke with lower-level whistleblowers who did not make the news. They did not make a movie out of it. And that's a very different experience. One whistleblower said that his ex-father-in-law had told him if he'd been a real whistleblower, he'd been on 60 Minutes. Well, it's not quite so simple as that. So how can whistleblowers learn what they already know? They have to come to terms with what I call knowledge is disaster. That in order to go on, to go forward with life, one has to accept some pretty terrible truths about the world. And most whistleblowers, as it turns out, are middle-aged and middle management. The reason is because they're in a position to see crime or ethical violations as a matter of company or organizational policy. And you have to reach a certain level in the organization to do that. So most whistleblowers are middle-aged. Most are fired, though it's difficult to measure these things. And theirs is an act of considerable consequence. Most will lose their homes. A majority will lose their spouses to divorce. And almost all will turn to alcohol or drugs for some period during their long journey in the wilderness, which for many whistleblowers I spoke with was already in its second decade. Some speak about their religious beliefs as helping them, but none spoke about their church or synagogue as being helpful. The way I did my research, I attended a whistleblower support group organized by something called GAP, the Government Accountability Project, which does a really good job with whistleblowers. And I listened to them come and tell their stories. And in addition, one successful whistleblower turned his farm into a whistleblower retreat. It's called Whistle Stop. You can look it up on the web, where whistleblowers, stressed out whistleblowers, homeless whistleblowers really, could go and spend some time. And I went to a retreat there. And I have to tell you that stories heard for the third or fourth time at 3 a.m. in the morning sound a little different than they do the first time early in the evening. Now, as I said, I'm not particularly interested in the high-profile whistleblower, one whose story made the news. For every whistleblower who makes it to 60 Minutes, for every whistleblower who wins a Supreme Court case 9-0, there are thousands who never get their day in court. The average whistleblower reports a case of Medicaid fraud amounting to less than $100,000. And yet, without whistleblowers' willingness to commit the truth, our country would be more corrupt. For many crimes of corruption, there's really no other way in than for somebody on the inside to speak. Now, I'm not going to use the language of Tavistock for the most part, the mechanism of projective identification, which, in my humble opinion, is used all too widely to explain all too many things. I'm not going to talk about the whistleblower in those terms, so that's the way I think that the scapegoat is made. I am going to refer to what Wilfred Bion called the tax on linking, a tax on knowledge, for I think that the whistleblower actually comes to embody or represent organizational knowledge that can be gotten rid of and then contemplated benignly at a distance, at a safe distance, at least for the other members of the organization. Now, I want to tell you about choiceless choice. The structure of the whistleblower support group I attended, or maybe I should say its ethos, was for the members to go around the table telling their stories. And since I attended the support group for over 6 months, and since most of the attendees were regulars, I heard the same stories over and over again. But that was an advantage, because at first I had it all wrong. Almost all the members of the group talked about what they'd done and what happened to them as a consequence with a sense of immediacy and intensity that led me to believe that most of them had just recently blown the whistle. In fact, it turned out that most of them had blown the whistle over a decade ago, several over two decades ago. There's something about being a whistleblower that's very hard to let go of, particularly when you've lost so much else. So, and my notion is that the whistleblower sort of really can't break free of this until he's come to experience what I'll call knowledge as disaster, and I'll characterize that knowledge. But in any case, it turned out to be an advantage to hearing these whistleblower stories several times, because I finally begin to get the point that the whistleblower believed he or she had no choice. Air quotes. I did it, and this is several quotes strung together. I did it because I had to, because I had no other choice, because I couldn't live with myself if I hadn't done anything, because it was speak up or stroke out. What else could I do? I have to look at myself in the mirror every morning. And this is what most whistleblowers say. The comments of several, as I said, strung together. And the question is how to regard this almost universal explanation, one that's generally offered gratis, that is, not in response to my question, why'd you do it? Because I ask generally fairly few questions. I just let them talk to each other. There's something formulaic about this explanation, and the trick is to find out what it's a formula for. And I decided that the answer is that the choiceless choice is a formula for relief from the almost unbearable regret of having sent oneself on a suicide mission. Most of us think that freedom's about having choices and making choices. The whistleblower understands that the freedom he or she has experienced comes closer to compulsion, one that can seize a person and never let go until it's destroyed just about everything the whistleblower holds dear: career, home, family. Jim Bauer concluded this way: I'm glad I didn't have a choice. I didn't think I could live with myself. I don't think I could live with myself if I'd chosen all this. Now, one could argue that this statement proves that Bauer had a choice, right? That his experience of compulsion is a way of avoiding responsibility for his choice. And it could be. It's impossible to know these things for sure. But one might as easily conclude that the listener, who cannot believe that the Bauer was compelled, may be defending him or herself against the possibility of such a threatening experience, that one could lose everything one cares about after being seized by an overwhelming principle, almost as though it were a god. So I took them seriously. But that's not to say I wasn't at cross purposes. I was interested in the whistleblower's experience as a way to learn about organizations. I believed, and I think I was right, that between the words of the whistleblower, I could discern the sources of his torment. Trouble is, this often put me in conflict with the whistleblower. The whistleblower wants me to tell his story, her story, to the world. That's every whistleblower just about is dying for that. And I had to be honest and say, you know, this is my book. I sent it out to several whistleblowers in manuscript form. Only one was disappointed and angry. But my job was to understand the sins of the tribe as experienced by the scapegoat. And sometimes this assignment put me in conflict with the whistleblower. Often not. I want to tell you a story about one whistleblower. In some ways, his story, too, is atypical. He blew the whistle on a project that threatened the lives of hundreds of people and was vindicated in the press. Most whistleblowers blow the whistle on more mundane acts, such as overbilling the government, and most are never vindicated. In this respect, Mike Quint, and that's his actual name, is unusual. Actually, a number of whistleblowers refused to sign my anonymity form because they wanted their name to be used. So Mike Quint is unusual, and typical and puzzling is the way he still suffers from his experience, because in the world of whistleblowing, one would have to call him a winner. Mike Quint is an engineer who exposed defects and cover-ups in the construction of tunnels to be used by the Los Angeles Metro Rail. Since L.A. is a site of frequent earthquakes, shortcuts in building the tunnels could have been catastrophic, in killing hundreds of people. And though Quint was eventually fired from the construction management company that oversaw the building of the tunnels, he persisted in his letter-writing campaign. As a result, the construction management company was removed from the project, the tunnel contractor performed 8 months of remedial work, and several employees of L.A. Metro Rail went to jail. And the question is, why does Quint take so little satisfaction in his victory? Not only does he say he wouldn't do it again, but that he's turned into something of a zombie on his new job. Whistleblowing, he says, has reduced my trust and faith in people and in our justice system. I now expect fewer benefits from work and perform my duties as directed with fewer questions on decisions or procedures. Why does Quint despair? He was right. The LA Times made sure that everybody knew it. And he got a job in his field again, all of which is strikingly unusual. So it must be his perverse choice to see the glass as half empty rather than half full, right? Well, what if Quint has lost the glass? What if he's lost the container that held everything that he cared about and valued, what he calls his trust and faith in people? I mean, these are simple words. But what if they really mean something? For some people, the earth moves when they discover that people in authority routinely lie and ask those who work for them to cover up. Right? Once one knows this, or rather once one feels this knowledge in one's bones, there's no going back. Most of us, by the way, get used to it. Don't even notice it. Some people remain aliens in this new world. They can never accept this insight that I think is in many ways fundamentally true. That people in authority lie and ask other people to cover up. Now, a decent society depends on whistleblowers, but we don't protect them. And that's why they're scapegoats. To be sure, there are hundreds of laws protecting whistleblowers, but they don't work very well. And the problem, I think, is that we need somebody who knows and represents the right thing to do somebody who can then be sacrificed so that we can forget, so that we don't have to know, or we can contemplate our sins at a distance in the body of another. And this is where I found Bion's attacks on linking helpful. I'll talk about that in a little while. Well, how do you listen to whistleblowers? Our ability to gain access to these narratives depends on what we are prepared to forsake in order to hear them. Lawrence Langer, who said this, is writing about listening to the narratives of Holocaust survivors, but it applies to whistleblowers too. Not because whistleblowers have suffered similarly. The suffering of survivors exceeds that of whistleblowers by orders of magnitude. And I have some basis for making this statement, having, viewed hundreds of hours of survivor testimony. Indeed, it's really the difference between survivors, the Holocaust, and whistleblowers that makes the point. Not as wounded, generally, as the Holocaust survivor, the whistleblower is more likely to just keep talking so that he himself will not have to give up the truths of common narrative, common knowledge, the stock stories we tell each other in order to make ourselves feel better, like the little man who stood up against the big corporation and won. That's a common narrative. Common narratives aren't lies. They're more like cliches, worn and out of context truths, insufficiently complex to account for experience. And so to know what he's already learned, the whistleblower would have to give up what every right-thinking American believes in. To forsake this is particularly difficult for the largest group of whistleblowers I worked with and listened to, conservative, middle-aged men. Bob Warren said, hell, I wasn't against the system. I was the system. I just didn't realize there were two systems. Most of us almost unconsciously figure out that there are two systems along the way. Whistleblowers are the only sort of intriguing empirical study I found about whistleblowers was that they were so among the least sensitive groups to social cues. Whether that's actually true, I don't know. But I think that they remain naive longer than most of us and have to forsake more as a consequence. So I want to list some of the things that Mike Quint would have to forsake in order to hear his story, in order to not no longer be a zombie on the job, as he put it. It's a long list. You have to forsake his belief that the individual matters, that law and justice can be relied upon, that the purpose of law is to remove the caprice of powerful individuals, that ours is a government of laws, not men. The individual will not be sacrificed for the sake of the group, that loyalty isn't equivalent to the herd instinct, got a ways to go here, that one's friends will remain loyal even if one's colleagues do not, that the organization is not fundamentally immoral, that it makes sense to stand up and do the right thing, and take this literally, that it makes sense, that it's a comprehensible activity. That somewhere there's someone in charge who knows, cares, and will do the right thing. That the truth matters, and someone will want to know it. That if one is right and persistent, things will turn out all right in the end. And even if they don't, other people will know and understand. That the family is a haven in a heartless world. Spouses and children will not abandon you in your hour of need. And that the individual can know the truth about all this and not become merely cynical unto death. I think without being able to give up these truths, or at least without coming to some sort of subtle accommodation with these truths, the whistleblower will be forever chasing his tail, telling the same story over and over and over again. Not only is it hard to come to terms with these truths, but one feels like when it's all over, that there's nothing left. "My case is not grievable," said Bob Warren. He meant that it wasn't subject to further grievance procedures. But I sort of heard it both ways, right? That he was not able to grieve over his experience because of what he'd have to give up. He'd have to learn too much about what he already knew. This is what I mean by knowledge as disaster. Not knowledge of the disaster, but knowledge as disaster, because it can't be contained within the existing frames and forms of experience, including common narrative. The result is that Bob Warren is stuck in chronological time, telling the same story over and over again. He was in his 10th year when I first met him. "I just can't live with myself knowing what I know," said Amy Brown with a long sigh. "I just have to do something about it." She finally did, but I can't get beyond the first part of her statement. "I can't live with myself knowing what I know." Amy Brown's a psychologist who went to the FBI over Medicaid fraud committed by her previous employer. Her boss went to jail, but she couldn't get a job again in the state where she worked. And this is actually a cliche now, I guess, among whistleblowers. "They were all afraid I might commit the truth," she said. "That if somebody asked me something, I might tell the truth." Eventually, she moved across country and got a job. You generally can in fields like psychology and nursing, in more closed fields like nuclear engineering. You can't. Amy continued, "My new colleagues, the one who didn't know my story, kept asking me if I'd been violated in some way. They meant rape or assault. There must be something about the way I carried myself, like I was scared of being intruded upon or something." She was. Amy Brown was violated by knowledge. The violation is the knowledge. Ordinarily, we think of knowledge as something gained. But what if knowledge implies and requires losses that one can hardly bear? The unwanted knowledge of the way the world really works invaded Amy Brown, possessed her, and the only way for her to get free would be to give up what I call these truths of common narrative. She's headed in that direction, but it'll take a while. Being vindicated, as Amy Brown was, is not enough, as it was not enough for Mike Quint. Now we're in a position to see why. What's the satisfaction of being right? If as a consequence, one has to give up everything of value one believed in. Another whistleblower, a nurse who reported an extreme case of Medicare fraud at her old job, had quit her new job when she discovered that the home health care company she was working for was bending the rules regarding eligibility for Medicare. And I said, "You know, I think you just can't stand being a whistleblower again." She said, "Oh no, you don't get it. What I can't stand is thinking that everybody cheats." So maybe I'll stop for just a second and ask if there are any questions or comments, and then I'll talk about nuts and sluts. that's whistleblower language, more the way the disciplining the whistleblower world. Any questions or comments? Yes. Yes, it is. And I suppose the reason I didn't
repeat the comment, please.
The comment was that knowledge is disaster is the way the Bible begins, right? It's the way the Old Testament begins, eating of the fruit of the tree of knowledge. Did I summarize that adequately? And the problem, I guess the reason I didn't think of it that way is because I heard this term in the context of Holocaust survivors' testimonies. And in some ways, that sort of just blocks out everything else. But I think you're right.
I think that works.
I'd have to change my theology a little bit to make it work. But yeah, what else? Questions or comments? Yes.
That also brings to mind the "you can't handle the truth" line in Two Good Men. Well, you know, that question about what is God, why is He preventing or trying to prevent the moment?
Yeah, and it's really ironic because we're talking here about truths about ourselves, ultimately, aren't we? I mean, what we're talking about is truths of ourselves as a creature of the group. That's what's unbearable. Right? Our nakedness, our intense groupishness. I wanted to talk about Daniel Ellsberg for just a moment. I guess one of the most famous whistleblowers. Actually, there was a TV special on him a couple nights ago called "The Most Dangerous Man in America." That's what Henry Kissinger had called him. And Ellsberg says that when he went public with the Pentagon Papers, those of you who are too young, the Pentagon Papers were reports, secret reports commissioned by Johnson and continued under Nixon, that showed very early in the Vietnam War that we weren't winning. We were never going to win. And the people who were writing this report for the RAND Corporation, good, solid citizens, didn't live with this knowledge, but didn't share it. And Daniel Ellsberg shared it, right? He went to the press, New York Times, and leaked the documents. And when it was found out that Ellsberg was the one, he said, "My colleagues didn't look at me with either admiration or censure. They looked at me as some awe, as somebody who cut the lifeline to the mothership, the military, industrial, academic complex." And I think we don't understand how utterly dependent we are on the mothership and what we'll do in order to remain tied in some way to the mothership. And I have to tell you that most whistleblowers don't understand either until sometime after they've blown the whistle. They have no idea generally what they're getting into. So Ellsberg actually, I talked to him quite a bit about this book, and he refused to endorse it or blurb it because he thought I was too discouraging about whistleblowing. And I could actually see his point. I don't agree, but I can see his point. Yes?
Any sense of why the people who were chosen to be whistleblowers, like how they, like why the group got them to do it, or what it's about, other than being middle-aged, and or is that the characteristic? Like, what is it about this group that we end up shunning away?
I originally thought that was my project, to try to figure that out. And I came pretty quickly to the decision that it would be sort of insulting to ask them questions about their childhood, their toilet training, whatever. And that I didn't really need to know sort of why, if my goal was to figure out the organization. Now, you suggest maybe it's a little more complicated, that if I could figure out what it is about the whistleblower that makes him the scapegoat. I guess the simplest thing I could say is I thought some of these people were remarkably naive in the sense of still believing that there was just one system. And that long ago, all of us, most of us, not everyone, most of us sort of figured out and just sort of put it away that there's two systems, the way people talk and the way people actually act. And the whistleblower doesn't learn this until he's too late. That's why I mentioned that study that social, the whistleblowers seem a group, as a group, this wasn't a great study, but to be least sensitive to social cues. And most of them don't fully understand that they're even whistleblowing until the process of degradation and elimination has begun.
Just sort of following up, but it seems to me like there's something about the group, though, that's putting it on the wall.
Well, sure, that was my idea. Like,
why would they choose them? Because the, you know what I mean? Like, being naive isn't, I don't know how to put the question.
Well, why choose this person rather than another person?
Right.
And do people volunteer for the role of scapegoat? I don't know, is the answer to your question. I know that the group needs somebody, and that there's something about true believers that makes them perhaps particularly attractive in this regard. I certainly think that you're absolutely right, that the group is using the whistleblower in order to get rid of, or at least put at a distance, thoughts or knowledge that they would rather not have. The whistleblower represents embodied knowledge. One more question.
Have you made any thoughts about WikiLeaks and Manning and how that changed?
Well,
anything?
I think WikiLeaks and others will change things. I still think it's most effective when there is a face, a human face, behind the claim. Now, in order to be effective, this human face, this human person, has to have done a good job collecting documents and so forth and so on. But there were, even before WikiLeaks, several groups that would take the complaints of whistleblowers, scrub them free of identifying information, and pass them on. It's simply not as effective as having a human face out there. And most of the whistleblowing I was interested in, I think WikiLeaks would not be particularly interested in. But about certain important things, absolutely. Absolutely. Real quick.
Did you find that the whistleblower was the only person who knew about the bad stuff that was going on, or was there wider knowledge of the problem, and are there ever any instances of group whistleblowing?
It's always other people know. And the whistleblowers, you don't get in trouble as a whistleblower if you say, hey, Bob down in accounting is raking off some of the money. You get in trouble when the wrongdoing you report is wrongdoing by policy at the highest levels. And that's when you get really into trouble. And there was a second part of your question I forgot.
Is there ever group whistleblowing?
I can't think of any, but I can't think of any. And I think there's something, I'm sure there is, but I think there's something about whistleblowing that's a profoundly solitary act. And one thing I'm not going to talk about today, unless you press me, couple of chapters in my book that I try to explain what distinguishes, for example, a whistleblower from a Christian rescuer of the Jews during the Holocaust. And the answer is that the rescuer of the Jews, there's a human bond. One famous rescuer said, I cover people, or I help them to cover themselves. And there's a bond there, a human bond, skinship. Whistleblowers have to imagine the bond in most cases, because in most cases the people being harmed are real, but the individuals aren't known. It's the whistleblower. And my explanation that I came up with, and that one or two whistleblowers took exception to, most didn't, was if a whistleblower acts from what I call narcissism moralized. That is a deep, I mean, there's, put it all too simply, right? If there's sort of two ways to be a narcissist. You lower the standards as low as possible, so you exceed them and you're great, or you set high standards for yourself and try to meet them. And it seems to me that what whistleblowers were most enraged about, actually, was that they've been asked to besmirch their own purity. And that this makes a tremendously powerful motivator, right? Because it goes to the very core of this person, the whistleblower's sense of him or herself as a person, that I've been asked to be dirty in some way. So that was sort of my theory, and why I think it takes an individual. But again, I'm not so clear about the whys of whistleblowers as I am about the organizations within which they work. One last question, then I think two questions. Is this going to work out on time? When do we have? Till 3 or 3:15? 3:15, okay. Yes, ma'am.
What comes to my mind is Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. And when he said it involves knowledge of losses that he can hardly bear, that really got to kill. And so I wonder what you think about Al Gore.
Well, technically he's not a whistleblower, because the definition of a whistleblower is somebody who speaks out from inside the organization about ethical, legal wrongdoings while still inside and subject to the retribution of the organization. Technically he's not. Sometimes I don't really think that. In some ways, sure, he's a whistleblower. I mean, anyone who speaks about inconvenient truths is. But I think he was in a fairly comfortable position to do this. But, yeah.
What I think what you're saying is that the whistleblower refuses to lose his innocence by incorporating his own shadow, the people within that are just like the people he's telling on, and that he's, or she is, then I would think, chosen for that very quality, because it then requires a certain kind of, you're saying, this zeal of righteousness to go through all this, thinking that you're different in some way from the people that you reported.
Could you all hear that in the back? I think that's right, and I teach at a university, and I've presented, you know, another version of this talk to professors of ethics and this and that, and they get very upset. They say narcissism, moralized, whatever you call it, is not an ethical motive, so it can't be an ethical act. And my answer is, well, but what if we reason from the other direction and say, look at this ethical act that's really quite rare. What would it take for somebody to be able to do something like this? And we tend to get stuck at that point. But I think something like the way you put it is probably correct. Though, as with anything else in this world, there's lots of different whistleblowers with lots of different makeups and situations. It's not all explicable by one theory, not even mine, certainly. Well, let me talk about nuts and sluts. The suffering that the whistleblower experiences has the quality of what Michel Foucault calls discipline. If you're an academic in any of the humanities, you know that Michel Foucault is a big deal, and so everything he says is a big deal. But nuts and sluts is the term that many whistleblowers use to describe the disciplinary process, referring to the way in which those who raise ethical issues are treated as disturbed or morally suspect. Right? That, and about this kind of discipline, one can't tell a good story. That is, one can't tell a human story about a human protagonist engaged in a meaningful quest for justice. Discipline works the language of science, medicine, and the law, by which whistleblowers are transformed from actors into patients. And let me tell you about Joe Klein. He'd struggled for years to make sense of what happened to him. An accountant for a large corporation, he's gone to his boss about the suspicion that they were overcharging the government on a contract they were working on. And this is what Joe said. First thing, they sent me to the doctor. Then they put me on medical leave. And when I tried to go back to work, they told me I was too sick. Before I knew it, they gave me early retirement and made me take it. Don't get me wrong. I got great benefits, better than if I kept my mouth shut. But that's not what I wanted. I wanted to do the right thing, save the government some money. Now I'm the one with the money and no job. Joe Klein doesn't know whether he's a victim, a hero, or a co-conspirator, and neither do I. It's a little bit of all three. So it's important the way in which organizations in which whistleblowers work generally tend to not address the issues raised by the whistleblower, but instead transform ethical disagreement into problems of insubordination, disobedience, mental illness, ethical failure, whatever. I mean, why do you think that Nixon had the plumbers burgle Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office, right, for information just along those lines? Or as one whistleblower put it to me, they wouldn't talk to me about it, and they wouldn't talk to me about not talking about it. It made him crazy. And I think it's the same way some parents make their children crazy. Or Zygmunt Bauman puts it more trenchantly. All social organization, he says, consists therefore in neutralizing the disruptive and deregulating impact of moral behavior. I'm going to repeat that. All social organization, he says, consists therefore in neutralizing the disruptive and deregulating impact of moral behavior. Whistleblowing means intervening in this organizational normalizing routine, generally through an act of individuality, one that remembers there's an outside to the organization and an inside to the person. And this inside need not and should not be understood as a rigid moral core. It's better understood as the capacity for dialogue, the ability to talk about what one is doing, a dialogue that takes place within the self and among others, real others in the organization, imaginary others affected by the organization. And the organization, I think, is generally devoted to suppressing this dialogue. When you blow the whistle, you become poison to the company, said one whistleblower. Your presence makes them sick. The Greek term for scapegoat is actually pharmakos, which means both poison and cure. It's pharmakos. The whistleblower is poison to the unity of the organization, which wants to obliterate every thought and every memory that the organization has responsibilities to those outside the boundaries of the organization. I mean, we study group behavior, right? Group boundaries, particularly in a world of other groups, is a tremendously fraught and frightening issue. But in practice, this means obliterating individuals who remember that there is an outside to the organization. Let's use an example of how powerful this poison is in the decision by the IRS to fire Jennifer Long, the only one of seven agents, IRS agents, who did not hide behind a curtain and speak through a voice-distorting mask when testifying before Congress about abuses at the IRS. On Monday, when she returned to work, said Ms. Long, every single manager was in her face with the same refrain, "You're not a team player." Now, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, William Roth, had warned the IRS not to retaliate against Long. And a year later, he warned the commissioner of the IRS in follow-up hearings. 2 days later, on April 15th, the Houston office of the IRS, where Ms. Long worked, fired her after spending a year documenting 33 alleged shortcomings, including the failure to write neatly in her appointment book. By the way, this is how whistleblowers are generally fired. The goal is to separate the firing from the act of whistleblowing, and this takes between 1 and 2 years, in which case, during which time the whistleblower is given either a series of degrading tasks, like having a nuclear engineer's office moved to a broom closet. I'm surprised how many times I heard this story about closets being converted into offices and told to mail out packages, or they're put in a position for which they're not suitable. They don't have the skills and they're bound to fail, or just a bunch of bad efficiency reports. And in 1 or 2 years, the whistleblower can be fired in ways entirely in accord with the law. Now, this case of Jennifer Long was different. Learning about her fate, Senator Roth went ballistic, new commissioner of the IRS saw red, and the story made the front page of the New York Times, which wrote about the pathology of an ingrained culture at the district office. Ms. Long was not fired. Her supervisors were punished. But consider that her supervisors must have known that in trying to fire Jennifer Long, they were putting their own jobs at risk. And yet they couldn't help themselves. It was simply intolerable to have someone like this in their midst. And this is one of the few cases in which it was not the whistleblower, but the bureaucrats, I guess we're all bureaucrats, but the bureaucrats who fired her were got in trouble. So the farmer causes poison, but as the Greek word reminds us, the scapegoat is also the cure. Not the ethical cure, for rarely do the acts of scapegoats encourage others to stand up and be counted. The pharmakos is the cure in the sense that the original scapegoat is the cure. The scapegoat represents what we all have learned about the organization but cannot bear to know. That it'll destroy us if we think too much about what we're doing and to whom. So we hold our knowledge at a distance, frequently in the mind and the body of the scapegoat. That is, after all, the purpose of the scapegoat. Not just to dispose of our sins, but to let us know them at a safe distance, so we might contemplate them dispassionately, as though they belong to someone else. It's a cruel distance, requiring not just the isolation of the whistleblower, but his isolation in the face of the togetherness of his tormentors. To be a whistleblower is to be frequently without colleagues and friends. "I was never real popular," said one whistleblower. "I know what it is to sit by myself in the lunchroom in high school. But I never knew what it was to be alone until colleagues I'd worked with for over 20 years wouldn't even look at me in the halls." And I have to tell you, this is actually the thing that bothers whistleblowers the most. Not that the boss retaliated. I mean, that at least is comprehensible. But the colleagues they thought were friends, colleagues with whom the whistleblowers had spent more time with than their families in many cases, refused to recognize the whistleblower, to look at the whistleblower, to eat with the whistleblower, even to take the whistleblower's phone calls at home. In refusing to do any of these things, colleagues isolated the whistleblower and with it their own terror. I told you about Daniel Ellsberg. There's something absolutely terrifying about cutting our link to the mothership. We'll talk about containing individuality. Rene Girard, who writes a lot about sacrifice, primarily ancient sacrifice, but also modern sacrifice, and he argues that ritual sacrifice arose out of the need of the primitive organization to contain the violence within, the violence that's always threatening to overspill its boundaries, turn group member against group member, and just destroy the group. And the scapegoat is sacrificed in the hope that the cycle of impure violence could be contained by an act of purifying, ritualized, controlled violence. That's the point of the scapegoat. And you might think that I would agree with this, but I actually don't. I think Girard has it backwards. That sacrifice serves not to contain and channel the ever-present threat of individual violence, but the ever-present threat of individual morality. Sacrifice serves not to rechannel destructive violence. Sacrifice serves to rechannel destructive individual morality that might result in the breakdown of organizational control and hierarchy. Sacrifice is mobilized against thought, not just against responsibility or acts, but against thought in the name of organizational autarky, organizational autonomy. In these circumstances, one who speaks out from the inside is what Jean-Paul Sartre calls viscous, a boundary crosser, outside and inside at the same time. The anthropologist Mary Douglas uses the term slimy to capture the same fear of one who will not stay in his place, or rather whose place we do not even know. It's what every organization, I think, is most afraid of, that someone inside represents the interests outside. The organization can't control its own boundaries. And it's what Jennifer Long's supervisors meant, the IRS agent, when they accused her of not being a team player. The language is banal, but the sentiment is profound, reflecting, I think, the deepest fears of organizational man and woman. And this accounts, I believe, for an otherwise puzzling empirical finding. Internal whistleblowers are about as likely to be fired as external whistleblowers. If you go to your boss's boss about something, you're almost as likely to be fired as if you went to the newspapers. And that's odd, right? I mean, you'd think it would make a big difference whether you went to the New York Times or to the boss's boss. It doesn't, because once you've shown yourself as somebody who remembers that there is an outside of the organization and an inside of the person, you are, at some level, a deadly threat to the organization to be gotten rid of slowly for the period of a couple of years in ways entirely according to the law, which is all about procedure, rarely about substance. So the whistleblower, it's apparent, need not speak out in the name of the public in order to get into trouble. He or she only needs to speak as though he were a member of the public within the organization, as if he or she remembered his citizenship in the world. The purpose of sacrificing the whistleblower is to prevent the outbreak of an epidemic of ethical and moral responsibility that would threaten to engulf the organization, destroying its ability, or so the members fear, to maintain its boundless autonomy in a hostile world of other organizations, each competing for the same scarce resources: land, oil, grants, contracts, consumers, students. Sacrifice always aims at halting an epidemic. In this case, an epidemic of individuality, as though it could be spread by example. Perhaps it can. Its spread is halted by making the boundary between inside and outside as clear as possible, for the real threat posed by the whistleblower is to remind the organization that it belongs to the larger world. Otherwise expressed, the boundary between organization and world is fuzzy. It should properly remain so, even if that makes people in organizations nervous. And in order to deter this way of thinking, this outbreak of ethical conduct, the whistleblower must be moved to the margins, not just of the organization, but of society. Excuse me. The task is complete, not when the whistleblower is dismissed, but when he or she is unable to work in his or her profession, unemployable at any sister companies, as the manager of one drug company put it, when refusing to hire a whistleblower who'd spoken out against dangerous practices at another drug company. Well, when all drug companies are sisters, there's no outside left. So, institutionalized violence and coercion are everywhere in ordinary public life, even if they're not generally recognized. The great contribution, I think, of the whistleblower, the great sacrifice, is to show us the consequences of stepping over a line that we didn't even know existed, over a line that at least we pretend doesn't exist. And there's lots of ways of characterizing this line. I'll do so simply in terms of the line between individual and organizational morality, whereas the individual represents a morality of the larger world inside the organization. Individual morality is about doing the right thing. Organizational morality is about fitting in. Or as one whistleblower puts it in talking about the real rules of the organization, organizational morality looks like this. You never go around your boss. You tell your boss what he wants to hear, even when the boss claims that he wants dissenting views. If your boss wants something dropped, you drop it. You're sensitive to your boss's wishes so that you anticipate what he wants. You don't force him, in other words, to act like the boss. Your job is not to report something that your boss does not want reported, but rather to cover it up. You do what your job requires, and you keep your mouth shut. These, says this whistleblower, are the real rules of the organization. I don't think they're literally the real rules of every organization carried to that extreme, but I think they reflect real tendencies in organizations that require the sacrifice of the whistleblower. What I haven't been able to describe very well is the way in which many whistleblowers come to learn these truths about the organization and about the limits of the truths of common knowledge. Like, if you stand up and do the right thing, then surely things will work out in the end. I think I must have, well, whistleblowers eventually come to feel these truths in their bones. It takes a whistleblower a while to figure it out, frequently a decade, sometimes two, and some never figure it out. I would like to say that when they do figure it out, they become in some sense liberated, but that's not the case. Knowledge and what to do with it are two different things. Not entirely different, of course, but different enough so that there's no guarantee that understanding brings even the compensation of truth. For many whistleblowers, the truth is not good enough and never will be. I want to talk a little bit about Beyond and whistleblowers, but let me ask again if there's any questions or comments. Yes.
Do I did you encounter with the organization that could contain the whistleblower and make some turn the poison to medication?
Yes, there are organizations like that. Here's the problem. Let's say you go to your boss's boss about something wrong with the policy of the organization. And the boss's boss says, gee, thanks for telling me that. I'll do something about it. And then the boss does something about it. That person is never going to appear on the radar as a whistleblower in the first place. So, in a sense, when you talk to whistleblowers, you only learn, you don't learn about the effective organizations. And so that's a limit of my study. There have been empirical studies comparing all sorts of different organizations and the rates of whistleblowing and so forth, but that's complicated by the fact that in some ways it's easier for government employees to be whistleblowers. But no, I didn't, but that by no means means that there aren't such organizations. The trouble is they just don't get counted because they simply are effective organizations doing their job. What else? Yes?
Perhaps I'm just asking you to write another book. That is, I was sitting here thinking about Abu Ghraib and all the witnesses who inadvertently became whistleblowers when their photographs were used. And they're not true whistleblowers.
No, they're not.
But there were obviously scapegoats involved in those situations.
Yes, and the scapegoats, we first have to remember, are the Iraqis, right?
Yes.
Second, that sure, lower level people who are given general directions to humiliate their charges and then left free without proper supervision, that's inviting disaster. But it doesn't mean that people like Lindsay England and others did not do terrible things. And I think my trouble is it suggests that there's an awful lot of people who right, especially in wrong circumstances, would do terrible things.
Yeah, I was going down that tangent when I was listening to you speak.
Yeah, I'm teaching my undergraduates right now about the Milgram experiments. I'm sure you're all familiar with those. In which, under the voice proximity condition, that is, you can hear the victim yelling, screaming about his bad heart, commanding to be let out, and then finally falling silent, 2/3 of the people delivered what they thought were volts of 450 volt shocks until told to stop. So there's something about us that is frighteningly compliant. And I would say, frighteningly groupish. And so I know this is a group that studies group relations, but I think a big part of group relations is managing the boundary between the individual and the group, and to use Winnicott's image, the organization that holds and does not crush or drop the individual. And that's, as you can know as well or better than I do, that's very, very difficult.
Mm-hmm. In listening to you, one of the thoughts that's come to me is in reflecting on how those of us who've been engaged in doing group relations work have, over a number of years, wondered about the limits of the appeal of this approach. And some of us have sort of often concluded it had to do with dealing with the unacceptable parts of human beings that were unconscious. And it seems to me what you're saying is it isn't only that, that there's an awful lot that is quite powerful that isn't unconscious at all. It may be people don't want to see it, but you're talking about conscious decisions consciously undertaken and not publicly, but certainly almost by policy enforced. So is there something about what we teach or offer people that sort of connects to the threat of not whistleblowing, but of being not so good a soldier in the army, so to speak?
I think the first rule in ethics is to say to yourself, to anyone around you, what you're actually doing in words that can be, you know, understood, that aren't just, you know, filled with jargon and euphemisms. Say what you're doing, think what you're doing, talk about what you're doing. One whistleblower who I'll quote, again, this guy who said his case was not grievable, said, "I'm afflicted by my imagination for consequences." And I would say my other sort of thought about this is to encourage people's imaginations to go visiting, to encourage people's imaginations to go wandering outside the boundaries of the organization, into those areas the organization serves, taxpayers, enemy combatants, whatever. But I think, well, you're right in a sense that, I mean, not all of this is terribly deep unconscious process by any means, but it's very easy not to talk about what you're doing and to whom you're doing it at the time you're doing. And what the whistleblower represents is somebody who did, and in some ways it's a relief to have somebody who did. But the whistleblower at the same time is removed at a safe enough distance, marginalized, so that one can know these things, which one already knows, at a safe and comfortable distance, embodied in the torments of the whistleblower. I'm a professor. I think about how could you teach whistleblowing to students, and I pretty much decided you can't. Though I do talk to about being a little melodramatic about your historical moment, that at some time in your life something will happen in some organization in which you work, and which it will be your turn. And by the time you get to that point, the decision you've made, the decision you will make, has already been made long ago by the time of the type of life you've lived and the things that you've thought about along the way. And I always like that notion. I don't know how to ever know if it's true or not. By the time you get to your historical moment, the big decision, you've already decided by how you live your life every day. I think that's often true.
I'm very mindful right now of the recent suicides of several gay young men and the idea of bullying and the work of Hannah Arendt of I Committed Jerusalem, and thinking about what we're each complicit in. And that sometimes, not that insurance fraud or the accounting things aren't egregious, with significant impact on human lives. But very often, the cases that demand whistleblowing are violations of people's rights, dignities, and safety. And that it is dangerously so easy for us to be complicit in that dimension. Yeah. And that seems to be the easier way to prepare people to intervene than perhaps thinking about the whistleblower.
It might be. And by the way, I told you I was going to use unattributed quotes, imagination consequences, and allowing your imagination to go wandering is directly from a rent, as you may know. So, I'm not sure I really agree that it's so important to make distinctions between whistleblowing on accounting fraud and whistleblowing on the harassment of gays or other minorities. The disagreement I had with Daniel Ellsberg, actually, was he said, do it to save lives or don't do it. And, you know, look, this is the guy's, you know, this is a very brave man. So I don't think I would have had that courage. So I don't mean to criticize him. But my sense is that no. Maybe in some ways the less important things are preparation or a way of thinking about the big things. And that, of course, reporting teaching about preparing people to be aware, and I would say preparing people to be aware of their unconscious prejudice, rage, hatred, could be a very useful thing. And I try to do that in my classes. That's what I think college ought to be for. I think it ought to be an ivory tower, not for the professors, for the students, so they can have 4 years to think about some of these things without the pressures of job and work and all this being quite so intense. So those are my random free associated thoughts to your question. Yes. I don't know. Is anybody over here? Does it matter? Yes.
I just had one question regarding what seems kind of bleak from what you described.
Seems so kind of what?
If you're a whistleblower, it's a bleakness. I mean, for 10 to 20 years, you're out in the wilderness, and it's really bleak. And I guess maybe I'm trying to rescue the idea of whistleblowers by living outside of Western civilization, maybe. And what people may have thought in China when the man stood in front of the UK.
Yes.
Versus what is thought of in the West, and if there is a difference, and what that difference might be, and how that might relate to like the idea of fatalism, the idea that in the East people are fatalistic. You know, maybe people were thinking, well, of course he's going to be in jail, of course he's going to be tortured, but he did it anyways, and they thought about it differently.
Let me tell you about the part of the East I can't tell you about Korea. I wrote 2 books on evil. One, what evil means to us, and then I went to Korea and Japan to study why sort of half the world doesn't believe in evil. And one thing I learned, young Koreans are much more aware of how much they're willing to sacrifice to belong to the group and to stay a member. Because it, in some ways, though it's changing very rapidly, but Korea is still a traditional culture. And I think the danger that the trouble Americans have with this is we're supposed to be the land of the free, the home of the brave, and the home of the individual. And at some level, it's lies. That in fact, what we are is creatures as group-oriented as any Korean, any Indian, any Chinese, you mention it. It's that in our culture, we deny it in a way that others don't. What I can't tell you about, because I didn't have time to study it, is whistleblowing in Korea. I talked to a few people about it. But I thought that the young people had a much richer sense in Korea of what they were willing to sacrifice and not sort of pretending to this autonomy. I mean, we don't really estimate properly sort of the limits of our complicity and spinelessness until forced to do so. And many people dedicate their whole lives to not knowing that. So I think there is much to be learned around the world. Well, let me just do the final part of my talk, which is, but I think this is about thought. I mean, you might just say it's all a matter of organizational intimidation. The organization virtually destroys the whistleblower's life and so intimidates everyone else into silence. And surely it's part of the story. But I think it's only a part. I think, as I've mentioned, that the sacrifice of a whistleblower is the embodied acting out of what Wilfred Bion calls a tax on linking. Bion's answer as to why some people can't think was what he called a tax on linking. It's easy to have thoughts. Anyone can have thoughts. What's tough is linking them together, connecting them, without being overwhelmed with terror and despair. A tax on linking seemed to stem from a hatred of thought itself, a hatred of knowing what one is feeling, born of an incapacity to contain these shattering emotions. The attack on linking occurs when unbearable emotions are broken into pieces, disconnected from thought, with the results that thoughts become sterile, one-dimensional, bereft of the emotions that would invigorate thoughts and give them life. the result of attacks on linking is a lack of curiosity, a hatred of emotions, of anything that would cause your imagination to go visiting. The sacrifice of the whistleblower is an attack on linking, embodied in one who thinks, sacrificed so that we do not have to. The whistleblower represents, or rather is, thought sacrificed. Thought about what? About what the organization is really doing, as well as one's own responsibility in the organization and what it should be. One whistleblower, I already told you about him, the same one who said his case was not grievable, put it this way, I'm afflicted by my imagination for consequences. He was referring to the possibility that children might climb over a fence and play on some ground that had been turned toxic by his company's sloppy waste disposal practices. The sacrifice of the whistleblower serves to erase the living link by embodying the one who has demonstrated publicly this imagination for consequences. With the erasure of the living link, imagination, thinking about the consequences, what is often called curiosity, empathy, and so forth, is similarly erased. The one who's done our thinking for us is no longer among us, and the normal division of the normal division or of the organizational division of labor can be resumed, the separation of thought and action. Focusing on the whistleblower and what he or she has to tell us about organizational life isn't a pretty story, but I believe it's the true story. Not the complete story, but a true one. The heart of this story is the organization's attack on thought and the generally unknowing and unwitting sacrifice of one who dared to think so that others need not, or rather, so that others can contemplate the organization's deeds dispassionately, disconnected from emotion, as though the thoughts belong to someone else. Finally, the thoughts that are unbearable are not limited to the misdeeds of the organization. Most unbearable of all, perhaps, is the knowledge of how terribly cowardly and compliant most people are within the organization, due, I think, ultimately, from their fear of separation from the mothership. Thank you. We have, what, 3:15, is that right? Did you want to say anything? Janet knows more about whistleblowing than any of us in some ways. So any more questions or comments? Yes?
I was linking to the problem of tenure, as you were talking, and to the challenge of trying to speak about, put into words, the very ways that knowledge is constructed.
Yeah.
And in some ways, we rely on and have relied on historically tenured people to be able to do that. And even that is now under attack.
Though I have to say, tenure is under attack. I think tenure's always been under attack. Our tenure has not always promoted thought. When I was a graduate student, there was a professor who had on his door saying, I can only summarize it, but it was the effect of, after you've gone through 5 years of graduate school and 7 years of earning tenure,
you did a good job.
You'd be able to think of anything you want. I said, well, by that time, it's too late. So I think tenure, certainly it protects thought. It protects thought against, I would say, more organized political interests. I'm not certainly having tenure is no guarantee of thought. Yes, let me get some people in the back.
So I was thinking when you were talking about a time in which I was Googling someone who I was about to hire, and turned out that this person was a whistleblower. And I brought that to my senior executive team, and it was just fascinating watching the group react to that information. And it was exactly what you were talking about. 5 out of the 6 people were terrified of hiring the person, right? So the question is, we ultimately did hire the person, and the person did a fantastic job. And by the end of that person's tenure at the organization, he was already starting to find things within the organization that were sort of, you know, in that line of things that all organizations do, that, you know, if you're compliant, you do them, and, you know, you should know that you don't talk about those kinds of things. He then left the organization, and he seems to be moving from organization to organization. It's just a very interesting pattern just before the sort of, you know, the whistleblowing is about to happen. And I'm not sure it's sort of egregious behavior all the time, but I really think it's interesting about this insider-outsider that you were talking about, and how sort of, from time to time, I recently had to give a reference for this person, and I was, I remembered immediately, the thing I remembered was the whistleblowing incident, but obviously I didn't raise it. But I decided not to raise it, obviously. I decided not to, because I thought it was a sort of an admirable thing, not just to tout myself, but I had witnessed the person's work. But I remember that feeling of really being confused about what to do with that information. And it was the whistleblowing was on Medicaid fraud. And, you know, it's just very interesting how that happens.
Yeah. Most whistleblowers will never, it's interesting to think of sort of the path that people take to get to being a whistleblower. Most of the ones I talked to, it was a different path. I mean, or maybe it was earlier in this person's career when they'd blown the whistle for the first time. They didn't fully understand what they were doing. But it is, I guess my answer is simply, we need better whistleblower protection laws. And, well, I was just thinking about it. I was getting patted down and looked at through this machine that looked at my clothes and everything by the TSA, and how it's been a prime interest of the government not to allow the Whistleblower Protection Act to apply to the Transportation Security Administration. And, of course, those are the people who are going to know, you know, how much is just security theater and how much is serious business. But yeah, there's something about the whistleblower that's frightening. I mean, I think, you know, at the end, that's sort of what I take away from your comment.
Right.
But there's something about the whistleblower that's frightening, alien, different. How do we deal with that? Sounds like you guys did okay.
I have something to say. I have a patient who came to me 4 years ago, a whistleblower, scapegoated by friends, family, job. And so what do I do with him? You know, he's a loner. And by the way, I resonate with every word of your presentation. And he's a loner. And so what do I do with him? I put him in a group, of course, because that's what I do with people when I don't know what to do with them. It's working out very well. But one by one, he's kind of knowing something about somebody and speaking up about it, and then he kind of gets the opportunity, do I want to stay with this or do I want to let go of my righteousness and look at myself? And so he gets this opportunity. Is he going to stay a loner, or is he going to join again and again? And are my beliefs more important than the relationship?
I don't really have much to add to that, except one more thing
is the self-knowledge. I love your talking about how the group doesn't want to know about itself. He doesn't want to know about his dark side. He wants to project it onto them rather than know it.
Yeah. I want to link with them.
Yeah.
And I was thinking of myself as an executive coach to a whistleblower, a potential whistleblower. What do you do in a consulting room with a potential whistleblower? And my sense was, as I was struggling with this journey of my imagination, is that this whistleblower will probably not want a coach, or most whistleblowers will probably not want a coach. That was my fantasy, and I was thinking of Daniel Ellsberg, very powerful, and he could dialogue with his girlfriend, and actually he refused, and she had to break up with him before he was able to reach that place. There's something quite lonesome, quite withdrawn or secluded in the dynamics. It's a fantasy, and of course I haven't done any research. I'm just thinking about, convening the application.
Just a quick comment. I sort of came to the conclusion that a whistleblower is not necessarily the first person I'd want to go out and have a beer with, but that without whistleblowers, we live in a much more corrupt and poor society. And in the end, I guess I really didn't care. What I wanted to learn, it was about the organization, and I learned enough. Okay. Yes.
He's so uncomfortable is because of what we know that we ourselves have failed to make known, what we cover up, because we are not quite so naive, and that we have indeed gone through our lives at making compromises at various points. Yeah. And it is very disconcerting to face in the other what we have failed to face in ourselves.
I think that's right. It's very difficult to face somebody who has not made those compromises, who didn't even know those compromises existed. Is there one more hand?
Now,
what happened when I began my research quite a few years ago, men were more overrepresented because it was the upper middle management. Now I think there's no difference between men and women in terms of whistleblowing that I can figure out. I mean, there might well be, but I certainly talked to enough women. And a few years ago on Time magazine, Women of Persons of the Year, it was three women whistleblowers. So it's changing. Thank you.